You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is an absolutely lovely one with an absolutely lovely person. This is Tom Neenan. He's the head writer for The MASH Report, the showrunner for Hello America on Quibi. We've all got Quibi, right? And he's also a deeply nice man. He talks to us about being the recipient of the BBC Writers' Bursary and how that kind of acted as a joke writing boot camp for him, which has left him in the position, the enviable position, of being able to just sit down and write a load of jokes. Imagine that. Just sit down and not bad jokes as well. Really good jokes. If I just sit down and write a bunch of jokes, I think my hit rate will be horrifically lower than someone like Tom's. We're going to talk about that bursary. We're going to talk about how it trained him up. And we're going to talk about how he mines ambiguity for a punchline and plenty more besides. If you're in the Insiders Club, there's 30 minutes of extra stuff available to you, including Tom on learning to make shows more personal. Me and Tom get self-indulgent, riffing on the concept of story and the Lubitsch touch, to which he introduces me with reference to the work of Pixar and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And also, Tom shares some of his favourite joke formats. And I might even, just thinking about it now, I might try and get Tom back for an Insiders Q&A, because it's a really nerdy conversation about joke formats that might be really fun if there was a bit, if there were more people involved that we could bounce off, then we could have a bit of a sort of round table about joke formats. He'll almost certainly be up for that. I'll bring you that in a couple of weeks once I've confirmed that he's into it. So all of the insiders at comedianscomedian.com/insiders for all of that. But now, without further ado, this is the very funny and very lovely Tom Neenan. So, mate, where do we start, Tom Neenan? Shall we start? I mean, I feel like my relationship with you started with The Gentleman of Leisure.
It did. I feel very, like, before... This is before ComCom, right? Like, long before.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... hang on, have I gone somewhere? I'm back. This is going to be one of those fun things to do. Yeah, so, like, me... when was that? That 2011, maybe? 2012?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at dates, no. But in my mind, it is a big, glaring 2011.
Yeah.
And I must do the thing as well, which I always forget to do at the top, which is to set the scene for people less familiar with your work, because, as we know, you are quite a shadowy figure and barely exist online.
Of course.
You are the lead writer on The MASH Report,
yes.
Is that right? You're the head writer.
Head writer. I share that role with a guy called Tim Telling,
gotcha.
Who is sort of... He very much has earned that role because he's part of the... He's like the Daily MASH side of that
gotcha.
Equation.
Okay.
So, yeah, so he's sort of the fictionalised part of it. But, yeah, I'd feel bad if I didn't mention him sort of off the bat.
Fair. You've made it quite clear now that that is something you felt compelled to mention.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he makes sure I do.
And also, you were the showrunner for Hello America, which is
yes,
bananas to be a showrunner.
It is. I feel so lucky. I mean, like, this whole interview comes under the caveat of feeling incredibly lucky. Like, we're in the middle of, like, an awful time when a lot of comedians, people are struggling. And, you know, so, yeah, for the first lockdown, the entirety of the first lockdown, I was the showrunner on this show, which called Hello America for Quibi, which was an ill-fated app. And it was great. I got to learn all these skills and do all these things and sort of do it a bit in private. I feel a bit bad saying that, but...
Oh, yeah, but the numbers weren't huge, right? Because Quibi was... Like, I don't even really understand what Quibi was still.
A lot of people don't. They won't tell us what the numbers are, which is...
I'm very clanging. Yeah. I can't believe I've said the numbers weren't huge, right? I'm picking up on what you said about, like, you got to do it in effectively, secretly.
It was a closed platform. And it was... All I mean by that is, like, I guess we have mutual friends who are also showrunners on stuff for, like, massive, huge TV shows and massive projects with a lot of expectation. Very scary.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I got to try out this thing on a much lower budget and, sort of thing. But with friends and with, with Nish as the helm, who, I trust implicitly. And so it was wonderful. I just feel so lucky, even though obviously it would have been great if we'd gone on to season 2 and 3 and 4, that I got this opportunity and this thing that I was able to do. And now I can put that on my CV and I can look at 18 or 19 episodes. I think it was in the 20s. I've completely forgotten. It's lockdown. It's just all been erased.
Yeah.
Of these episodes, I'm so proud of, and were sort of a bit of a, all of us were just sort of learning this thing, and it was an incredible experience. So I kind of, this, like I say, this whole thing comes under the umbrella of just being like, it's not been too bad in lockdown so far.
Yes.
And I realise that I am in the minority. Maybe, I'm in the minority for that.
Yes, anyone with any class who's done well in the last year has to constantly caveat it with, and I recognise how lucky and fortunate I've been under the circumstances.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so okay. That's me doing that above. Also, just in general, I was born a white man who can walk and see. Like, this is all very, I'm very privileged and everything else. So please let that be the banner which kind of covers all of this.
Well, the thing is, I was describing you to someone recently. Mm. That was one of my things. I like to hang out and describe you to people.
Sure.
And I was sort of thinking, I didn't realise I thought this, but in describing you, I sort of said, well, I suppose he's sort of, he's almost a throwback to when, to a sort of bygone era of Radio 4. I kind of think of you, Tom, don't take this the wrong way, but I sort of think of you as an almost a kind of Bob Cratchit of Radio 4. Like, one of the writers in a cupboard, right? Who, like, obviously is churning out. Churning's a terrible sentence as well. I'm not very good at this.
It's fair.
But you producing a huge volume of material, just, if you need some jokes, get him. I've got a mate who's a mathematician. And I said to him years ago, I said, so what, like, professionally you're a mathematician. What businesses just say, we need some maths done, get him. And he went, kind of like that. And I sort of have this, I imagine you, maybe it's because of scarves and Doctor Who or something, and that's connected you with Bob Cratchit in my mind. But I sort of feel like you are like a kind of, you have qualities in common with an archetype of a BBC Radio 4 comedy writer who is locked away somewhere and allowed to write.
And I think maybe sometimes, because I should say that probably that comes from the fact that I did a job which I think only one other ComCom guest has done, which is the BBC Writers Bursary, which is literally that job. You, for a year, it's like, it's an entry-level job, but for a year, you literally are in the department and they ask you to write on shows that aren't like auteured, basically, kind of those kind of shows. So that was what I was doing. So for a year, you sit there and they say, you've got Now shows and news quizzes every week and you've got Dead Ringers and all those things and they all come around and you literally just churn out the material. The downside of that, I guess, is that, like, for one thing, I came out of that having, and it was like a boot camp for writing in general, not just like gag writing, but all kinds of writing. It was really helpful and I really appreciate that I got that opportunity. It's so great. When you come out of it, I guess one thing you want to do is get the idea that your writing is like of value and also like something that kind of is, is something that people, venerate is too big a word, whatever the difference is between sort of having no value and, being very valuable, that kind of thing. Where, because you do churn out loads of material. So when you, like, maybe are developing a narrative show or something, you want to go, but I haven't just churned this out. This isn't, like, half a weekend's work or whatever.
Yes.
So it's kind of a balance. But, like, it's a great opportunity. And I do not, I don't want to speak ill of it at all because it's a great way to learn how to write. And, and I think I probably did that. When would I have done that? So, like, that. I did that when Nish went off and did his first solo show, and then I did the bursary. And so that was lovely. And so then we were actually able to rejoin when Nish was able to host a show, and I felt I had enough clout as a writer to then sort of be a head writer on it. And that sort of all married up very nicely. Yeah, but then obviously what you want to do is also, having churned out loads of material, also go, but when I write something that it like matters, you go, but this has, this is special in some way, I guess, to me at
least.
Is it? Mm-hmm.
do you think, a preconception of yours that people might think you were churning stuff out? Or is that something spoken about in hushed terms among bursary recipients or BBC? Kind of, because it's like being a staff writer, I imagine.
I think that has been what the job has been called in the past, actually, has been staff writer. So, yeah, it's like, it's literally that. It's, yeah.
And so did you feel going into it? Well, I mean, first off, how did you get it? And why do you think you won that post compared to the next schmuck?
I basically, it's a very good system that the BBC has, because the BBC obviously is publicly funded, and so they need to have something which gets new writers through the doors. And so they have things like Newsjack and other sort of open door shows. And sort of it's a long winding road how I sort of ended up there, if that's of interest to people, which is basically that sort of I started out as a studio runner. That was like my first job out of university, where at a Pinewood Group Studios in Teddington. And there I worked for a show called, there was a show there called After You've Gone, where they had a writer's room. It's one of the few shows that has a writer's room. And so I used to sort of give special attention to that because I wanted to write. So I went to this like room in the studios where all the writers were to sort of, you know, punch up the scripts mid-rehearsal. And then after that, they needed a writer's assistant. So they remembered me from that and they invited me to go in for it. And so I sort of did an interview for that and got it. So then I was a writer's assistant on this show, one of the few British shows that has a writer's room. And then it was cancelled after 2 weeks. Like, that'll be a recurring thing.
The Neenan effect.
Exactly. I do my best. But what was lovely is there's a guy there, one of the writers called Dan Tetzel, who then went on to create Newsjack, which is one of the open door shows.
I didn't know that Dan Tetzel had created Newsjack. That's a name and a face that I know. And I didn't realise he was the... Okay, gotcha.
Oh, maybe he didn't. Maybe, like, Newsjack was, like, from a few people. I think Salush Gulani's another producer.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Worked on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But so I think there was a few. But certainly he was the first script editor. Okay. And then he recognised my name when I was submitting stuff and was like, it's just a nice thing. He didn't, like, you know, he didn't give me any special special privileges. Yeah. He was just like, oh, that's great. And then they invited me in and I sort of started being a commissioned writer on that. And then it just sort of... you know, incrementally, you sort of learn how to get better. And so by the time that the post was available again, I sort of was, my name was in the running, which is really lovely.
And is there just one? Who wins it? Is there one bursary place?
There's two. So it's okay. Two every year.
Gotcha.
And I was in a run of just lots of men did it for a long time. So it's me and a writer called Jack Bernhardt, okay, who's great. And he's brilliant. He has a lot of journalism now as well as sort of TV and radio writing. And so we did that for a whole year. And I don't know, I think maybe I want to walk back my initial kind of worry about churning stuff out, because I think some of my favourite writers do churn stuff out. Like, I've been listening to an interview with Russell T. Davis this morning, because he's promoting his new drama. Mm. And, like, when he was, you know, working on, you know, my favourite TV show, Doctor Who, he churned out scripts like nobody's business. And they're, you know, there's nothing... Churning, I don't think, has anything to do with quality. I think it's just about the sheer volume of material you need to produce sometimes. And sometimes, actually, if you're in a... if you're in a particular... have a particular work ethic or working a particular way, you can actually increase the quality of the work you're doing and the volume. But, you know, you need to be in a... I think that's quite rare. You know, people rarely sort of achieve that.
Let's just sit with that for a second, because I think that's a really good point. I remember being very kind of shook years earlier, sort of years ago, in the beginning of my comedy career, where someone told me that... I can't remember if they were talking about Al Murray or Harry Hill or both, but they were saying, well, the great thing about this act is they say, I'm going to go and write a show now. And they go off for a month and they come back and slam down a script and they go, there we go, I've written a show.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, God, I could never do that. You know, for me, it's just this kind of, it's like that meme from Always Sunny where he's like got the corkboard with the red things. It's all just like maybe that and bolt that on and what have you. So I'm really excited about the ability. Like, what must that feel like? Is it empowering to think to yourself, as to have that kind of staff writer gear of going, well, the pages 9 to 22 are blank, but I'll just fill those with jokes?
Yes, it's really good. That's the one thing that job taught me, which is it teaches you just to start writing, which is so useful and such a an amazing skill, which I'm really grateful for. So yeah, you don't have that fear of the Word document with the blinking cursor. You can just like go ahead and start typing, because you have to, because back in my, you know, the news quiz needs 15 jokes by the end of the day, or you know, someone needs gags added to a script or something.
When you say it teaches you to do that, is it simply the fact of a deadline that is imposed by an organization who have sort of bestowed mercy upon a young writer? Like it's an important gig and there's a deadline every single day, and that's
exactly
okay.
Some people I think have come away and not enjoyed that, but I really got something out of that, which is just the fact that it has to be done. And similar with Edinburgh, right? Like Americans look at the UK model and they're like, how do you even do that? And we're like, because there's a deadline, because every August we all turn up at the same place and show what we've done for a year. And so I think that we just have it in our head that we do that. Maybe a lot of it maybe has to do with authority as well. We kind of imbue Edinburgh with this like strange amorphous authority that like it will judge us in some way and we'll be sort of judged by the end of it. But it's all just deadlines, isn't it? And the more you have and the more you give yourself, it's like, you know, if you want something done, give it to a busy person, right? So it's that format, but sort of writ large.
And just before we get on, I'm going to come back to the idea of judging, because I'm obsessed with that at the moment. I think I'm sort of circling some sort of personal breakthrough to do with how I regard audiences and the industry such as it exists. So we may come back to that. But just sticking with that, so there's the deadline and the busyness. And then were you actually kind of taught externally? Was your work marked almost, you know, because it sort of feels like, I mean, I always imagine the BBC to look not dissimilar to Hogwarts inside, no matter, I mean, it's a sort of a slightly grey carpeted Hogwarts, but do you know what I mean? Like when you are the recipient of that bursary, is it simply that you get a job and then you have loads of different bosses, or is there anyone looking over your shoulder and going, that bit you need to try harder with? And so, you know what I mean? Is there a kind of teaching element like that?
No, it's up to you. So like you can become your own, you can grade yourself in terms of like, it's the amount you write. And then also it's if you go to recording. So if the radio theatre, when I was working there, we worked at Wogan House, which was just like, it was just next to the radio theatre. So it was very good. So you could write stuff and then obviously you could just go across the road and you'd see stuff recorded in the radio theatre. You'd see whatever, you know, shows that had an audience, you could watch them being recorded. And then when you've written something, and someone, a very talented actor or presenter, is saying it on, you know, in front of an audience, and you very quickly know that's working. Oh, and this thing that I was trying isn't working. So you're grading yourself the whole time and going, well, there's the audience reaction, and it's an honest reaction, because it's even probably not that honest. It's probably even generous, because they're in the radio theatre and their job is to laugh. So you're listening to that the whole time, and it's the kind of job that is, you can make it as instructive as you want it to, because you can go to all these recordings and hear your material read out and be harsh on yourself and go, that didn't work, and then sort of learn that way. That's what makes it such an intense and great learning curve, I think, that job.
And is there a kind of common type? I mean, you often hear people sort of describe the Radio 4 listener. Do you know what I mean? There is sort of a type there. And was there ever the feeling that you were specializing in tickling the funny bone of a particularly comfy listener?
Potentially. I'm trying to think. I personally, and I think a lot of people do, because it's a relatively young person's job for like you say, a comfy listener. But I think it's always fun to try and push it. There's stuff that, like, there's jokes that I've written that sort of stand out for me, because I was like, this won't get read out. But then, like, back in my day, Sandy Toksvig doing the news quiz, did them and they were broadcast. And there was stuff that I can't believe that we got away with.
Can you give us an example? Is there one that occurs to you?
There's one that I'm so proud of, which was where she... it was about sort of the government giving out jobs for young people or something. It was like a young person's job scheme. And at the end, I just wrote a job which was like, you know, jobs for young people include, you know, washing up in a restaurant, blah, 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 and marrying Stephen Fry. And it was, which when that was relevant, when that was a thing. And I was like, fair mate, she won't say that, but I'll put it in as a thing. And of course it got this, you know, it got this like, ooh, from the audience. Be like, oh, we got away with something, which is not rude. It's just like, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit proddy. And that was quite fun.
Yes. I remember as a teenager, I suppose, watching Have I Got News For You and feeling like it was sort of Rapier-like satire, and then getting older and kind of going, oh, this is pretty cozy, isn't it? Like, do you know what I mean? These people aren't out to change the world so much as sort of, you know, the mockery is kind of, well, I don't know. Did it soften, do you think? Or is it just that I got older and I started caring about it in a different way?
I don't know. It's hard to tell, because some of the things that arguably you could say about specifically that show, Have I Got News For You, that it did, now you look back and go, oh, is that satire? Like, everyone talks about, like, they had, Roy Hattersley didn't come on, so they had a tub of lard on. You're like, oh, okay, so you sort of, you reduced a politician down to his size. Okay, like... Yeah. Back in the day, oh my god, that's great satire. But now, sort of in a new, looking back on it, you know, the show's lasted 35 years or something. So of course, tastes will change in that time. You sort of go, is that satire? Is that the kind of satire that we want to be? You know, that necessarily you see as like holding truth to power. Is calling Roy Hattersley fat, you know, telling truth to power, or is it a bit of body shaming that, you know?
Yeah,
back in the 90s.
Yeah, of course. I suppose to a certain extent, I need to kind of confess to a. I suppose I have an agenda. I'm recognizing. I'll leave this in if it stays interesting. But if it stays or gets interesting, but
yeah.
I suppose I'm so in awe of people that can turn up and knock out loads of jokes that I think I've kind of set myself. With my own kind of preconception that, oh, it must be formulaic. Do you know what I mean? Like, it must be sort of comfortable. It must be a bit of a tombola where you slot in. I don't mean you personally, but you know what I mean? Like kind of Radio 4 comedy. These are the politicians we mock for these reasons.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's these 20 names. And if someone's lazy, it's this person. If someone's there, it's this person. And it just feels a bit kind of plug and play. Now, I don't know whether that is a reasonable criticism or whether it's more that I'm like, there's got to be some trick. Do you know what I mean? Because I can't. You know the way people watch people doing improv and go, oh, they must be rigging it. You know what I mean? So maybe that's kind of from a cynical thing. But I don't even know really what the question is. But do you think there is...
No, but that is true. Like, you definitely... When you have to produce that amount of gags, like, maybe not for the ones that are broadcast, because that might not be what the host wants, but certainly when you just have to produce a volume of gags, there is a formula. There is a formula. There are things that you end up doing. Like, was this... Well, I can't think if this is now. I've listened to so many ComCom pods. I don't know if this is my theory or if this is... a Gary Delaney thing. But, like, somewhere in my mind is the idea of, like, a news story is two things colliding, right? That's what makes something news. So a person does a thing, or, you know, who, what, why, where, when, all that stuff. So, like, basically, each one of those things has things that we attach to them. So, you know, Boris Johnson, loads of kids, you know, weird hair, all this stuff that you attach. And then you have something else. You have, like, the health service. So if those two things are in play, basically... To some extent, what your brain is doing is spinning both wheels and finding, like, common factors. Boris Johnson visited the hospital this week, probably, you know, visiting one of his kids. You know, I'm not going to try and pitch any terrible liners, but you can sort of go, you do end up kind of going, oh, there's that bit from that bit, and there's that bit from that, and if you put them together, that makes an adequate one-liner.
Yeah.
And then when you're writing those, you hope that a bit of something extra strikes you, which is when you actually write a joke that you think, oh, that doesn't abide by the formula. There's, for instance, I think the most formulaic is, like, I've done a lot of writing for Mock the Week and things like that. And on the scenes we'd like to see, the best ones work on a very strict formula. And when you sort of hit that, you're like, okay. And then occasionally... You know, they all work. And then occasionally someone, James Acaster, someone I think of a lot, who sort of breaks the formula and just does something really weird and brilliant that kind of doesn't abide by that, but still works in the sort of very restricted confines of that joke setup. So like with scenes we'd like to see, you find yourself going, okay, things you wouldn't hear a sports commentator say. And then in your brain, you just go through every aphorism of a sports commentator. Oh, that the ball went over the line. And you're like, okay, you're just looking for ambiguities in the words. You're going, okay, it went over the line. Okay, that went over the line. That comment was definitely sexist. Something that, like, you know, you can then just find an ambiguity in a phrase and then use it as the punchline, basically.
Okay.
And that is kind of a, I guess that is kind of the formula that they work by. But you do loads of those and then hopefully you hit one or two that don't abide by formula, but just like your brain throws out because they're funny.
Yes, I'm trying.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I want to kind of circle the idea of ambiguity because I think that's really important. And I think that's where I fall down as a writer of short jokes, because I'm constantly trying to force myself over to a position of finding ambiguity rather than accident. Like, I loathe puns, and it's because often they're all I can think of. That's like the very first, that's like level one of thing that's a word like that. So finding the ambiguity is important. I think the example I was thinking of is someone like Acastor or someone like Milton Jones, where you go, they're not really puns. Like, you know, I found a small dead baby ghost in the road the other day, although thinking it might have been a handkerchief. And that sort of exists outside. You're just like, whoa, how does your mind work like that? So I suppose what I'm interested in is a kind of a, I suppose what I'm asking is, what you're saying is, once you get familiar enough with all the formulas, then it sort of opens up and you start to see the spaces in between the formulas? Something like that?
I'm not musical. It strikes me as the kind of thing that jazz musicians do when they know the notes and how to assemble them, and then the fun becomes, but what if we break down this chord structure? What if we sort of ignore the rules, as it were?
From the perspective of someone who really understands the rules.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's good. I think that's a really good foundation for then writing gags, is having written like the most, or any kind of writing. You write something that's very, you just know the rules and you learn all the rules, and then you can actually earn the right to break them, I guess.
Yes.
Like how a lot of people, I guess, when they start out, want to immediately show that they understand the rules by breaking them. But then the foundation isn't sometimes there, and so there's sometimes it doesn't quite work.
I think a really good example of this sort of thing, I'm going to quote one of your, I'm going to publicly RT one of your tweets.
Oh,
is that, what's that called? is that called subtweeting? I've never understood what that is.
No.
Your joke that you, this is it today? 2 days ago. Oh, the sad irony is, if Jack Torrance had just written down what was happening to him, he would have written The Shining, a very successful book. That is such a magnificent joke, and so unformulaic, and so kind of... It has all those beautiful qualities of a joke whereby it's obvious once you think of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also is imbued with your personality. The fact that he would have just written The Shining, like that joke could have ended there, but it's pure Neiman to go, comma, a very successful book. Because it has a sort of gentle humility afterwards. In the, you know what I mean? It's like, it's a very short, small number of words. It's effectively a one-liner, and yet it's imbued with personality. So I just wanted to raise that because I think it's a good example of that kind of thing.
That tweet did well, and it infuriates me because any goddamn writer knows you don't put you don't include the same words in the setup as the punchline. So it should be, if Jack Torrance had just transcribed what was happening to him, he would have written The Shining instead of written down, because you got the word written twice, and it really irritates me.
Well, does it? Because I hadn't noticed that, and I think it would be worse. The more correct version that you've just said would be a less good joke, because I think obviously that's arguably one of the rules that can be broken once you know the rules, because we would all recommend someone don't say the word twice. I mean, maybe there's also something about the difference between written down, what was that, like writing something down is different to writing a novel. So there's a different sort of sense to it, but also maybe it's that it's there's something about the sort of gently labored way in which you're explaining, like step, isn't it? It's in step with the perspective of the joke, which is, why didn't he just do this? You know what I mean?
Very basic.
Yeah.
And I've got loads of replies to that being like, excuse me, he dies at the end. So like, how would that even, and like, which is lovely because it's just a logic, which is also like, I love that stuff. But there's one scene that I'd like to see, which, because I'm going to defer a lot because he just had a nice thing of quoting something, which I'm like, I'm quite proud of that one. and so I'm going to mention, a scene we'd like to see, like you wouldn't hear at Christmas. One that just sticks in my mind is one of James Acaster's, which is, things you wouldn't hear at Christmas. And he just says, did you hear that, Alfred? They said jingle bells, Batman smells. How dare they? And it's like, he's just created this world. And it's lovely because it's not anchored to anything. It's literally just like, and that has the same thing. He's imbued Batman with this real petty kind of feeling of victimhood. And it's nice when that's a whole story. And it's a whole little, when a joke can do that, when it can tell a whole little story and a perspective and everything else, those are really fun. And I think that one I wrote, I think it was one where literally I'd just woken up and it was such a stupid thought. And actually sometimes the thoughts that you catch yourself having, I wish there was a way of capturing those thoughts that aren't even really formed. There was a joke in my 2018 show, which is an idea I've had since I was like 14, which is just an audio word search. So it's just me sort of garbling, going that, blah, 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 blah. And then just over it, I just shout the word chicken. And it's like, you have to find that word. But it's like, it's such a, obviously it doesn't work and it's stupid, but you're like, those are the things that people like, because they don't come, there's no logic at play there. It's almost like an absence of any kind of...
Yes, a gleeful absence of logic, which particularly in the concept of a word search, which is a very rigorously logical thing, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And that's what I'm looking for more. Like, I think that doing things like the Burst Screen, doing lots of Radio 4 writing, gives you this skill to kind of... If someone just called me up tomorrow and went, give us 5 pages of jokes on X, I could probably do it. And that's quite a handy thing for, like... you know, paying the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And then the stuff that you kind of write where you want to go like, oh no, but I want to get and access something that feels special or feels like unique. I guess that's when you tap into the stuff where you're like, oh no, that doesn't actually, it sort of breaks the rules a bit. And that's really fun.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So with those sorts of jokes, with those kind of small jokes where you're like, oh, this is a, you know, it's a dafty, or it's, I always think of dafties, Alfie Moore's jokes. You've got to chuck in a dafty. And those are absolutely, I think those are kind of particular favourites of mine. Jokes that comics can't see coming. That's what you want to write, really. Whether or not that translates to financial success and fame. Because there's a lot to be said for writing jokes that comics can see coming. But are they ideas newly minted that pop into your head and you manage to capture them? Can they be edited? Can they be improved? Can you construct from perspiration rather than inspiration, let's say, beautiful daft jokes like that? Or do they happen accidentally whilst you're slogging?
Interesting. Well, there's two things that, as in, like, can you aim to create those kind of silly jokes?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe some people, I like to think that someone like, somebody who comes up on this podcast, something like Mitch Hedberg, he just thought like that. You could probably just, you know, if you talked to him about trains, he would have like 8 great one-liners that you've never thought of about trains, because you just point his weird brain in a direction and go, think about this for a bit, and they would just like churn out these incredible things, which I'm very, you know, which is incredible. But on the other side of that, obviously what you've got is you've got this silly idea, which is like this word search thing. But then because my show that year included like AV stuff, so it had like audio visual things, what you then got to do is the perspiration of actually making that exist, which actually becomes more logical, I guess, because what you want to do is tell the audience everything so that they can follow the silly idea with you. And sometimes that does take work. Sometimes you can't just go, imagine if this happened, and then they're sort of bombarded with too many weird ideas at once. You haven't walked them through it enough. So like that, the sort of the bit that led up to that, there was word searches, and I did a few gags about word searches. And then I said, and I came up with this brilliant idea. And of course, I'm playing a sort of an idiot. Yeah. So they're like, it's not going to be brilliant. Audio word searches for the blind. Let the sort of visual of that sink in, and then be like, okay, you're confused. What happens is I play me saying a load of nonsense words, and then I recorded myself doing it and played it to the audience with a real word inside. For instance, this, and I didn't say what the word was, but I was like, for instance, this one I'm playing you now is farmyard themed. And then I had another little clicker, and it would just be me shouting the word chicken over the top, which I tried to time so it got the best sort of reaction. Yes. But it was, you know, it's a very reliable kind of woofer, that one.
Yes, gotcha.
For the show. So it's like, it's a silly idea that came from nowhere and is almost like instantly, but then you've got to go like, okay, but I need to do the legwork of going, how do I walk them up to this fun idea so that they can enjoy it as much as I did, you know, when I first thought of it, kind of thing.
Yes, that's a good point. So I'm interested as well in the editing of something like that. When you do stumble upon a golden dafty, you know, when you're like, oh, here we go. Can you edit it? And if you are editing it, is the editing from the point of view, like sharpening it, tweaking it? I think when a perfect idea just falls out, temptation is, oh, don't touch anything. It's kind of, that's, I don't want to mess it up. Can you then trim it and retain or improve the magic?
I hope so. Maybe some things shouldn't be played with. I like so many people I hear, and I'm going to refer back to, you know, like previous episodes of the show where people talk about like recording a show where they did a preview and suddenly just there was a way that they phrased something and it just worked. Mm-hmm. And then they go, and it never worked again. And it's like, I wonder if sometimes it's a bit of slippery soap that you're like, oh, it worked that one time and it was perfect and it felt organic and I didn't even have to work at it. It was just natural.
Yeah.
And then the second you think about it, you lose it slightly. So maybe some things you just shouldn't touch as much. With that one, I think I thought of it, like with the Shining joke, I just thought of it. And then I think it did take sort of a bit of, and then obviously I probably wrote it with the thing. And then at the end, I thought it'd be funny to add the sort of pathetic caveat at the end as well. So yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Mm. So with that in mind, and we talked about your Edinburgh shows as well, you're not, when you do Edinburgh shows, they're kind of themed shows. You're not a stand-up. You're not there going, I'm Tom Neenan. No. I don't think I've ever seen you do that.
No, like I did myself, my 2018 show, I did like myself as a character, but it was very much a character show, just the character had the same name as me.
Gotcha, okay.
So yeah, but no, I've never done, like back, you know, many, many years ago, I did sort of bits of stand-up, but never, like everyone does, I think, like at some point, like, you know, sort of dip your toe in the water. But no, I've never for any prolonged period of time or for an Edinburgh show done like a stand-up show.
So when you are doing, because I remember seeing the Andromeda Paradox, was it
Paradox?
Which is, really enjoyed it, and it just spilled over with jokes. It was so dense.
Yeah.
The punchline density was extraordinary. and I suppose what I want to know about is the performance of a beautiful little one-liner. Because I think my working process is to, definitely like, I've got to record all of my gigs because if I'm lucky, I'll say something, I've got an idea in my head, I've never managed to say it perfectly, and I can sit down and push it round the plate as long as I want to. But I know that when I'm on stage, I'll accidentally say it, and then of course you nail it, and you go, that works, and then the downside is either the recording doesn't work and you're lost, it's lost forever, or you listen back to it, and then you end up trying to faithfully repeat not just the word order, but the cadence and the rhythm and all the rest of it in a way that now I sort of feel a bit grotty about, because that feels like you're trying to sort of cheat by replicating the perfect organic moment sometime. Do you know what I mean? It's like, no, you should be more like Phil Kay and just try and feel a genuine organic moment every time with all of the...
But some, like, I don't know, sometimes, because some jokes rely on intonation, right? Sometimes some jokes kind of, they live or breathe on the fact that if you perform them right, which is nice. Like, I'd like to give myself more... I think what those shows, so I did like the Ghost Story show and then I did the Sci-Fi show.
Yeah.
And they were both products of doing the bursary and just going like, I know I can write jokes. So I'm scared. I'm going to do my first solo hour. I'm going to lean back on the fact that I know that I can do tons and tons of one-liners, you know, or like, and assemble them in I can write stories as well. And I can assemble them in a story with a character and everything. And all of that will work. And I think as I've sort of done more Edinburghs, I've realised that it's also fun to strip that back and to make it more characterful and maybe have things that do rely on intonation and aren't just like, because I worry sometimes with those shows, which I'm really proud of, I could have emailed someone a PDF of the script and they would have got like, I'd say about 80% of the same experience.
Oh, that's such a performer thing to say. Oh, that's such a comedian thing to say. Like that's I don't know that I disagree with that. I think that is a very laser guided piece of self criticism. But the way that you've like, I could just email them a PDF of this. That just seems that's very kind of flavorful. It's very characterful in and of itself. Yes, I see what you mean. And I, having seen the show, like you, I don't know how much you were. It wasn't visceral. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't a visceral performative experience. It was a brilliant load of jokes that made me laugh.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And so what I've learned, as I've done more, I've been trying to lean into, like you say, something with my my latest show, people would like, because it was a lot about feminism and stuff like that, there was like three instances where groups of lads would walk out. They would go like, this isn't for me. And those are my favourite bits, because then luckily no one was ever like, didn't go too wrong. Yeah. But like, there was a lovely atmosphere and I could feed off it and I could make gags off of them and you know, sort of refer to them afterwards. And then suddenly, like you say, it becomes a visceral experience rather than a perfect thing that I'm trying to recreate every single night.
Yes.
Which will drive you mad, because that's like, And that, you know, unless you're a theatre actor, which I also have tremendous respect for, but for a very different number of skills.
So this is Tom. I mean, come on. What's not to love? What an incredibly nice man. We will get back to this in just a second. I'm promoting very little at the moment, so let's promote Tom. You can follow him on Twitter, at T Neenan. He's got very, very funny tweets. Absolutely. We'll talk a bit more about those in a sec. You can also follow his Doctor Who podcast, at Wheezing Pod. Check the show notes as well for some bits and bobs. We talk about some of his favourite instructional YouTubers in this episode, and in the Insiders Club extra stuff as well. So check the show notes for some tips on those. And there's also a link to the video about the Lubitsch touch. So if that has piqued your curiosity, then check that out in the show notes. What I'm up to at the moment is reworking my website and making it act as a node. Yes, I needed a node for some time. For all the things I'm doing, the key things that I am leaning into at the moment, besides an upcoming show at Catherine Bohart's Gigless Preview Festival in a couple of weekends' time, the key things I am pushing are virtualofficeparty.co.uk, which is going great guns. I'm pleased to see we're getting some more bookings on that into the new year. And that is for you if you are remote working and have a business that you, or are part of a business which you think you would like to bring people closer together via the magic of me live vision mixing a Zoom room and doing either a chat show or a stand-up show with some invited guests and involving a front row of people with, I mean, really well. I'm just going to say it there. This is my baby and I do it incredibly well. So check out virtualofficeparty.co.uk and consider booking us. And if you would like to learn what the distilled wisdom of over 360 now comedians that have been on this podcast can teach your business about resilience or authenticity or anything bespoke, then you can go to comedyinsights.com and learn about that. Follow me at ComComPod on Twitter and Instagram. And remember, the Insiders Club extras are available when you sign up at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Now, let's get back to the brilliant Tom Neenan.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I would imagine that having worked on the last 3 seasons of the MASH report, has that had some sort of... I'm going to say radicalizing. I don't mean that, but do you know what I mean? You write more and more about politics. You write more and more about, like, when you're putting, if you're the lead writer, you're working on Nish's monologue at the beginning of the show.
Yes, yeah.
Then it is by nature, it's a kind of passionate, it's a more, not necessarily ranty, it's articulate, but it's anger and it's directed anger. Mm-hmm. How have you found that? And have you found that it has made you more political?
I'm not sure. Like, I think that the reason, you know, that Nish and I have worked together for a long time, and we do share kind of political passion, I guess, and that obviously he has then turned that into, wears that on his sleeve. He's like, that's predominantly what he will tweet about. That is what he will talk about when he's on, when he's on anything, he'll make an effort. Like, I noticed even recently he did Graham Norton, and he sort of, I'm not sure whether it's his impetus or something, but he made the effort to sort of be satirical, because I don't think he likes the idea. This, I have no idea if this is what he thinks. Yep. But for me, I'd imagine he doesn't like sort of doing stuff unless he can be making a point or using his platform, mm-hmm. In a positive way, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess coming through Radio 4 feels softer than, say, the MASH report, which, yeah, definitely has more of a point of view. But I think that's always been there. And I think there's like, I don't, yeah, I think that the stuff that I try and write certainly doesn't feel like it's coming across in like a ghost story or in like a Quatermass parody, but like, maybe it's like buried too far deep, and that as I kind of, as I try and strip back the layers, there is a bit more of that kind of, you know, whether it's very rarely anger. I don't think I'm a particularly angry person, but you know, the sort of the edgelords who prompted stuff like the George Orwell mm-hmm. tweet and stuff like that, just, it's an eye rolling kind of, oh, I went through that phase when I was 15 or something, where you think that you're being incredibly radical by going against the grain, and actually sometimes the grain is just there because it's helpful. And so like, I think that more and more that comes out, and I think that more and more I'm trying to access that and the things that I actually, you know, that I care about. And the Mashport's a great example of that, because we can, it's all, you know, we just have to sit in a room for like, in that case, 6 weeks, you know, 5 days a week, six weeks, and keep up that passion and keep up that energy. That means that you don't just go, cool, these bloody politicians, eh? What are you going to do with them? Like, you actually go, no, these people need to be held to account, and keep that passion going. And I think that's really important. And I think I'm trying to access that more in the stuff that I create on my own as well, which has been really helpful. And like, that's why I love working with Nish as well, because he brings all that, you know, the like you say, being articulate and passionate and all those things. And it's a good, it's like a battery. You can sort of feed off it a bit. And that's really helpful.
Do you think it does hold people to account? Do you think politicians change their minds as a result of satirical swipes at them? Do you think that voters change their minds? Or
no, but I don't think, you know, the phrase that is often used specifically about kind of satire can be like preaching to the choir. But people preach to the choir. people say that like it's a bad thing. And I'm like, that literally happens. And it's not, you know, sometimes the choir need to be preached to. Sometimes, you know, and sometimes just enough voices presenting a certain point of view. There's enough in the UK right-wing voices that, you know, you need those public voices of kind of that criticise the government as well. As much as possible. And yeah, maybe you're not actually going to reach into people's brains and change their minds, but you will be part of a broader discourse, and that tries to level out kind of the, what is it called, the Overton window, kind of tries to stop things just lurching one way or the other, and sort of hold the government to account. Sure. Basically, like, what's the spectrum of kind of publicly agreeable political discourse.
Okay.
So yeah, and so if you're a voice on one end of that, and meanwhile you've got people, we've got this supposedly going to be this like Fox News of the UK on the other side, I think it's important that both exist. Or maybe I prefer if one didn't exist. And still, that's just my leanings.
And do you have topical things? Do you have kind of lines in the sand? Do you have things that you think are unfair as targets for satire? Right, you mentioned the Roy Hattersley thing. Was there anything on Mash Report thus far when you thought actually this isn't fair, or this is too, you know, even if you approve of the target, you think it might be too clumsy a means of attack?
Oh, I don't know. Obviously, sort of, this comes with the caveat that I'm, like I say, my sort of territory as head writer is not the whole show as such. So are we just talking about kind of stuff that I work on and I kind of have jurisdiction over?
Well, we were, but now you've mentioned that, it makes me think, oh, is there other people's stuff that you might have thought about?
No, I think it's all like, it's good. I think that the voice of like the voice of, like, say, the news desk is maybe a bit grumpier and a bit older, but that's fine. I think that's good. I think that that's how you end up with a show with different flavours and different textures. I disagree with anything on that. It's just, it's fun that, like, it's a lot more like, oh, you know, they'll probably have a pop more at sort of younger people, and you know, I guess I am one of those younger people, and I'll be like, yeah, we suck, but I wouldn't necessarily turn the gun on myself in that instance.
Yes, okay.
So, but like, in terms of other targets, I'm just trying to think. No, I mean, like, we as a room, I think we have a fairly good grasp of like who we want to attack, and also make sure that we're doing it properly, and that we're not sort of, we're not part of the Twitter mob who sort of has half an idea about something and then goes after someone based off of not much research. You know, a lot of it you know, we try and do as much research as possible to make sure all our targets are specific and are warranted. Occasionally I'll do a joke that I'm proud of where the victims are like, it's so unfair. There's one joke that that I Am Proud got on that is that is mean, but it was just, it was after a sketch about the Curse of Strictly, where I think Felicity Ward was playing like this very kind of sensual dancer who was like, flirting with her partner. And then I just wrote a line for the newsreader at the end that was just, of course, the real Curse of Strictly is that a third of its presenters have died. And like, there's no, you can't defend that joke, but like, you know, you go, well, it's fine. You know, God bless him. Bruce Forsyth lived a long and happy life, and you can sort of, you know, that felt like it was on the right side of being a bit mean.
Yes, but I think that's okay. Fair enough. Do you think that jokes are inherently amoral? Because I change my mind on this, I think, because I think there is a school of thought that says, listen, if a thing makes you laugh by being sufficiently surprising and satisfying, then there it is.
Hmm. I mean, I've heard people on this show within 20 minutes go from saying a joke is like a magic spell that you cast on the audience and then go, it's just a joke, isn't it? So, like,
I think maybe that's the real magic, is that it is both of those things.
Yeah, like I think anything you say has meaning and has weight, and so I don't think that there are jokes that have been made in the past, you know, in the past like 10 years by some people on like satirical shows and stuff, where I've been like, actually we could do without that kind of, you know, mainly kind of stuff like judging female celebrities by the way they look. And things like that, where I'm like, oh, that's not actually that helpful. And sure, people might laugh out of shock, but then also there's another thing, which is if it's a broadcast medium and it's going out to lots of people, that's one thing in a room where it's like, oh, we're all sharing this little secret, like I say, we're co-conspirators. But then also it gets broadcast to millions of people. And I wonder then if that kind of joke is very fun and enjoyable in a room of people who all understand the context, but then is very cold and harsh when it's on a television screen. So, like, I don't necessarily, I believe in free speech. I think that people should have the right to say whatever they want. But then, of course, it's a different thing when it's edited and sort of stamped with the show's approval, I guess, when it goes out. So I don't know what my answer is there. I think that, like, jokes, yeah, I think experiment with the most awful things you can say. But I do think that the delivery method of, like, especially like television and radio, and to an extent like tweets and books and things like that as well, carries with it a weight that then you need to consider also what you're, you know, the ramifications of what you're saying, the ramifications of the laugh you're eliciting.
And have you ever had any kind of negative effects? I would imagine your role, if I think of someone like Nish, we've been referred to a lot in this episode, you know, obviously, by putting himself forward, by being the person that delivers the opening monologue on the MASH report, he's taking a very specific line and is therefore subject to a load of abuse online. Presumably, you're spared all of that. Does it have any kind of bearing on the fact where you write a joke and you think to yourself, well, I'd love to sub this one, I'd love to pitch this one, but like, it'll wind people up and I'm not the one that's going to suffer as a result. Is there anything like that in the mix?
I don't think so, because I think that Nish has such a good filter on what he, on what he's prepared to say and what he can defend as well. Like I think that he'll always run something through the filter of like, oh my God, that might be something that's really radical to say, but can he defend it? For instance, in the room, we had him pointing at a sort of GIF an image of like a big neon sign that said Boris Johnson is a liar and a racist. Very inflammatory thing to do, especially on the BBC. And we were like, that would be incredible if we did it. The thing is, we have very good fact checkers and people who keep us in line legally, and they okayed it. And so if Nish can say, Nish will say, oh, that will get me abuse online, and that will be a very extreme thing to say. But if he can defend it in his own mind, he's fine with it. And I think as long as we're all going by that, then I think that's okay. Weirdly, I think like the only things where, you know, me and him have actually disagreed is stuff like tiny stuff. Like when Boris Johnson got a dog, and then like Nish was like, oh, screw that dog. And I was like, it's not the dog's fault. So it's like, it's tiny stuff like that. But on bigger things, as long as we can defend it, and as long as it's based on what is, you know, what our legal team and everything else allows, then I think he's prepared to go for it and take the knocks.
I know that you have a some background in improv. And I'm interested in the link between people who have done improv, which is very spontaneous in the moment and and all that sort of stuff, and people who also have the gears to write and sit down and focus on things.
Yeah, yeah.
The more and more I do this podcast, Tom, I'm realising it's just me flailing around going, what am I supposed to do to everyone I have on it? I think that's always the secret. That's always been the secret of the show. Less and less secret as time goes on. But what if anything have you taken from improv into your writing? Are there links? Are there useful kind of parallels?
Oh, so many. I think that, like, and I'm not going to try and be like a cultist, but it's whether that, you know, I did that. How many years ago was that I sort of went through the courses at the Free Association, which are brilliant. And I think what it does, it just codifies a bunch of rules that are really helpful. So, like, one thing that their specific type of improv does is, like, it's very based on a thing called game, which is basically, like, yeah, there's a scene with two people and there's a game being played and you want to make the audience aware of what that game is as soon as possible. And that's brilliant because, and all it does is codified in your mind that if you're writing something, if you're writing a scene and if you're writing for characters, that they have to have a clear point of view. So the audience are always tapped in because it's all about communication. It's all about clarity. Everything I've ever learned about writing boils down to communication and clarity. So it's like, can you communicate what the game of the scene is and what the characters want? And once you've sort of nailed those, everything else comes. Like, it certainly made me, in my other writing, in my like narrative writing, lean less on gags and more on the comedy that comes naturally from two people interacting, which ideally is, like, you know, which is a lot more satisfying from like a from a narrative point of view. Yes. Not necessarily, you know, gags have their place and I'm not doing those down, but like when you want interpersonal relationships are what, you know, all other narrative stuff is based on. And so I find that has been really helpful instructing that kind of writing.
And that's interesting because there's a parallel there, I think, with the ambiguity you talked about earlier on. It's like, as a means of not being simply gag-based, finding the ambiguity of the in between the concepts is sort of quite similar shape, isn't it, to finding the game in between two people.
Yes, although, it's sort of, ironically, the ambiguity there is almost death in terms of, like, if people aren't quite, you know, as long as people know what they're meant to know,
that's very good.
Yeah. But it's like, it can be, I guess it's so difficult, isn't it? Because, it was a long learning period when I sort of started that, because I've got in my head that I can, like, create gags and I can throw out gags. And, of course, actually, gags are death in improv because they suddenly break the sort of myth that what you're seeing is like two characters interacting, and suddenly someone's on stage trying to be funny and nothing's less funny than someone trying to be funny. So that was like a weird way of like unlearning that, which I'm really grateful for, because I think otherwise I would have taken my like, I can write one-liners and taken that into the world of like writing narrative, and then I would have struggled because it's a completely different skill set.
I don't disagree with any of that. I suppose the parallel I was imagining is that they're both somehow to do with, maybe there isn't a parallel. I feel like it's something to do with keeping the ball in the air. So it's not about ambiguity as in what is the ambiguity between these two people, which would be a big problem to the drama or the comedy or whatever it is. But there's something about finding the ambiguity between two ideas is like that's the exciting zone, isn't it? And finding the game between two people in the exciting game. Almost like the ambiguity is the game of the joke, isn't it? We're playing, that's the area that we're kind of teasing around.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, sorry, I think I misunderstood, but, like, you're absolutely right. It's that kernel at the centre of something, which is, like, ideally, two characters who disagree or have conflict, that in the centre is the kind of, is what you're talking about. It's that play, isn't it?
It's the
play of, like, the same play that has, oh, I think that this person's about to say, you know, things you wouldn't hear at a train station, and I think they're going to talk about the conductor of the train. Oh, my God, it's the conductor of an orchestra or something. You know, it's that kind of little play that then people respond to. I feel very bad about being so derisory about this.
I totally get it. So I just want to, before we wrap up, I just want to talk to you about, because you are such a, I think of you as like you're a kind of a fixer, right? You get it, right? You're a bit a beautiful mind, but for jokes. but still, sure. still a perfectly functional human being. And I should say,
yay.
One of the things I don't actually know about you, know you as a sort of, I feel like I know you from this interview, at least I know you sort of cerebrally, but I don't, we might just, before I get to my fixy thing, I was going to say, I just, in terms of who you are a bit more as a person, like what do you get from comedy besides money and a nice time? Like and then maybe nothing else, but what drew you to it? What kind of kid were you? What kind of, do you see what I mean? Who are you beyond the kind of the cerebral?
So I think that's something I'm sort of in the work I'm trying to do to access. So like I got into writing through sort of the topical stuff, because that is the easiest way of getting into writing, because it's the smallest outlay of money you can give someone, is like money for a one-liner. It's the smallest amount of work you can do for a small amount of money, and then you can incrementally grow up. And it just sort of, that's what I've been doing. And I really enjoy it. But like, I think my heart lies, as I've been talking about a lot, in sort of narrative stuff. When I was 18, as Nish well knows, I directed and wrote a film that my friends starred in, and sort of I made that in the summer between that and university, and that is kind of what I think ultimately that's kind of what I'm aspiring to, is that kind of, I love stories and I love we share similar things, the MCU, things like that, things that I'm kind of really passionate about, and using kind of writing, that kind of writing, but then accessing the kind of screenwriting and stuff like that, which I'm also really passionate about and really love. So I guess like the me who doing comedy is like using, just happened to be writing comedy because it's, I think that all writing should have comedy in it. I think that all drama should have comedy in it, because if it doesn't, it's, as Russell Davies says, it's, real life is funnier than most dramas. So why not have comedy in it? And so using comedy then to sort of, inform every other bit of writing I do.
So that was Tom. Thank you so much to Tom for coming along. A joyful episode. One of those ones. It's just so much fun spending time with him and just riffing about comedy nerdery that I might try and get him back every so often on the podcast. Or indeed, we might try and do one of these insiders-only Zoom Q&As. We did one with James Acaster, and if you're in the Insiders Club, that is available to you now. So please sign up, and you get all of the extra content from every episode that has it, which is now bundles and bundles and bundles. So if you've just discovered the podcast and you're chewing your way through it, then have a little look on the Insiders Club to see all of the extra bits from some of your favourite episodes. I'll post amble at you in just a second, involving also some correspondence on last week's episode with the brilliant Jordan Brooks. For now, that concludes the podcast. Speak to you soon. This one's been shortened to the point, hasn't it? You can almost tell that I've got research to do that I haven't yet done, and am getting on with this at pace. Hey, I tell you what we've got in the can. Correspondence in a second. First, we've got this. Next week or the week after, we'll be releasing an episode. It's always we, isn't it? We'll be releasing an episode with Russell Cain, and blow me down. I nearly told you that I had him in the diary last week, but I was so excited about it, I didn't want to hex it. I never like to say things until they're in the can. And it's an absolute belter. It's 2 hours of, he's so analytical, he's so erudite, he talks with such speed, you get the content of 3 hours jammed into two, and it's just a really good episode. I challenged him on lots of stuff, and he had answers for all of it, and there were some of those very pleasing kind of revelatory, I suppose things are like that kind of things. It's a gold standard episode, which I'm really excited to bring you. And speaking of which, not only has this one with Tom been a banger, but also last week, the Jordan Brooks episode, I'm pleased to say, has been very well received, as I knew it would be, because it is, he's brilliant, and it's a brilliant episode. There's nothing else to it but that. So thank you to those of you who've been in touch. Some of you have been in touch and said on the ComCom Facebook group how much you've enjoyed it. That's really great. I'm very grateful for all of those murmurings of appreciation. A couple of you have been in touch to check that I'm all right, which is so so sweet of you. I think, I can't remember, I retook the postamble of that episode a few times and I can't really remember what I said. But the upshot is, yes, I'm doing more therapy at the moment. Yes, I'm finding it very helpful. And yes, it's having a pretty sort of earth moving, earth not earth shattering. The earth is not shattered, but the earth is sort of pleasantly moved around in a way you think, oh, progress. Regarding sort of my compassion for myself and regarding the... let's not lose ourselves in it. But basically, I think what I tried to do in last week's postamble was make it about you and not me and remind you all to be a bit kinder to yourself. So thank you, those of you who took that as a suggestion that I've not been being all that kind to myself. And let's face it, it's therapy, isn't it? In some ways, I've been massively overindulgent for the whole of my life. And in other ways, I could probably have been... I could probably have achieved the same things with less bullying. So there's that. My point is, thank you for getting in touch. You can do that. info@comedianscomedian.com if you would like to contact me about anything. Follow me on the socials @comcompod on Instagram and Twitter. My own account on Twitter is @StuGoldsmith, and I absolutely cannot decide what to do with it because I never look in it. So there's that. I mean, follow it if you like. There's very little on there. So the one thing that I wanted to share with you before I bugger off is I saw last night, I sat in the audience, you know, every so often in the real world as comics, I often suggest that you sit in the audience of a show. We all watch other people's sets and we sometimes, I mean, I can't bear to sit in an audience, if I'm honest. I get really fidgety and it's very hard doing research sometimes, even if it's something that I'm really into. The idea of sitting down and watching a video or, you know, a YouTube video of someone that I love still kind of gives me the horrors, because the idea of sitting and doing it and not doing anything else, maddening. But I sat in my sitting room, which is what it's there for, with my wife at her behest, and we watched Tim Key doing some readings from his new book of poems. He used, I think it's called He Used Thought as a Wife. And it was so, so good. It was Tim, and I think he has a different person with him doing the sound each week. Last night it was Izzy Sutty, who is also brilliant, and the pair of them had this incredible kind of really downbeat riffing chemistry that was such a joy to watch. And Tim's just in his, not to give anything away, but he's in his flat and he has one or two different camera angles and one or two surprising things happen. And it was so funny and just made me feel for an hour that I was at the McCunclith Comedy Festival, and it made me remember the world. And I suppose in the last year, we've all been drifting in some ways, drifting away from what we're used to. I think that is, there are very few things that are universally true for everybody's experience over the last year. Christ, nearly a year now. But certainly we've all drifted away from the way things used to be. And I suppose some aspects of those for me have been good. You know, I've not been on the road. I've been with my family loads and I've been loving it and finding it difficult. But, you know, because it is, parenting's hard. But I've been loving being at home. And part of me has felt like, oh, you know, so distance. I've been quite enjoying in some ways the absence from my former life, from some of the tougher aspects. You know, comedy's full of things that it's really great to have done and to look back at and go, oh yeah, I used to do all those drives, I used to do all this. You know, that's very satisfying, much less fun to do them. God, if you were teleported, imagine now, if you're listening to this and you're a pro comic, imagine if you were teleported back to day one. Obviously, what a vast and exciting journey that would be. But wouldn't part of you be thinking, Christ, have I got to do all these difficult bits again? I'm losing my place. My point is, I have not missed certain aspects of it. Of regular life this last year. And last night, watching Tim and Izzy just being so funny and charming and brilliant in a really kind of gentle, casual, offbeat kind of a way, really made me just go, no, I don't, I miss all of it. I want the drives back. I want the gigs back, the dressing rooms back, the festivals back. I want all of it now in my tummy. Yes, right now, please. It was really inspiring and brilliant and funny. He's doing more of them. He's on Dice FM. So go to dice.fm and you can find out. I believe it's part of Leicester Comedy Festival. I believe if you're a Next Up subscriber, then you already get access to it. So look into all those avenues. I'm not exactly sure how it works. But it was so good. So I highly recommend that. And I highly recommend seeing things. There are so many. I've been too busy producing my own stuff. I've been too busy knocking stuff out and then recovering from knocking stuff out and then inventing things and surviving and all those kind of things. I've been so busy doing that, I haven't really done the equivalent bit where you actually sit down in an audience and watch a show. And I did, and it was great, and it was very inspiring. So do more of that. Yes, you. Bye for now.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.